You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
I am going to spend very little time introducing our next act because I probably don't need a lot of introduction. Brian Eno and Liz Slade are going to be talking today about what it feels like to be an outsider in a religious space. But I think we can all agree that even though they may feel an outsider in a religious space, they are very much inside Greenbelt and very, very welcome at Greenbelt. Everybody give a warm Greenbelt welcome to Liz Slade and Brian Eno.
Hello.
Is that sounds like it's audible? So I'm Liz Slade, and I'm really happy to be here with Brian Eno. Many of you probably know him from being the producer of most of your favourite albums, or from being a pioneer of ambient music. In fact, he's created so much art and music, it's impossible to recount it all here. I know that he's even released a new album this week, which I think is the third of this year. So he's a ridiculously busy person. And as well as his art and creativity, then his activism is really important to him as well. And I want to say that he's also manages to find the time to be deeply kind and generous and has deep integrity, which I think underpins all of what he does. But we first met several years ago, and in conversation, Brian said, "I've been an atheist all my life, but I've recently been getting interested in religion." And so we started talking and have kept in conversation about the place of religion in society and its relationship with art ever since. And so we're really happy to be sharing some of that conversation with you today.
And I'm going to introduce Liz now. So I'm going to be a little bit biographical about it. So Liz was born in Dorset, grew up there in a, I don't know what you'd call it, a lower middle class family, something like that. Yeah. Became successful in the language of science, actually. In fact, her first jobs were in science. And rather like me, at some point along the way, started having feelings that didn't quite belong within the languages that we individually knew, hers within science and mine within art. And I started to think, what are these feelings I'm having and where do they belong? And are they useful? Are they good feelings to have, bad feelings to have? Liz, a while ago, wrote about her feeling at this point where she finally diagnosed in herself something that she called a God-shaped hole. And I don't know if I would have used exactly those words, but I guess that's what I was thinking as well. It sort of catalyzed for me when I was living in America in the late 70s and early 80s, and I started going to gospel churches because I loved the music. And I found them very deeply moving. Whatever the quality of the singing was, it wasn't actually to do with music, I realized. It was to do with seeing this many people doing something together in a spirit of sharing and companionship, not in a spirit of this will further my career or I'll be the best at this. And I realized that I was really looking for some different kind of sense of community. So that was my God-shaped hole, and I still don't know whether I'd call it a God shape or community-shaped hole. But perhaps we can start conversing there and thinking about what did it feel like for you at first when you started to sense this, and where did it lead you to start thinking?
So I started sensing this, I guess, in my early 30s, and I felt like, oh, well, I'm ticking the boxes of a good, you know, aspirational middle-class lifestyle. You know, I'm going on nice holidays and I bought a flat and all of that sort of thing. But it was like, oh, it doesn't seem to be working. And I remember sort of thinking, oh, well, I wish it was religion, but obviously it's not that because I don't do that. Even though I'd grown up in a Christian family, like a lot of people, dropped it as a teenager and didn't give it much thought again, particularly as I was working in the world of science. And I thought, well, you can't do science and religion. But then I discovered just down the road from where I lived, there was a Unitarian church where the minister not only used to be a scientist, but was also an atheist. And I thought, okay, that feels like a safe kind of church to go into. I feel like we are looking at the world in the same way.
Yeah.
But little did I know that that would be a doorway that opened up into a world of, well, opening a door into my into a spiritual life that I never knew I could have.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think with me what happened was being for many, many years in this strange position of loving this music and not having any interest in the ostensible message that it was putting across. And I realized it was sort of the wrong message. So I was being told that this music was about something doctrinal, but actually what was important about it was what it got people to do together. In fact, I grew up as a Roman Catholic. I went to a fairly sort of strict Catholic school because I got a scholarship. So I was sort of in a rather favorable position given that I came from a working class background. And at school, I made the fatal mistake of producing the or getting the religion prize one year. And it was a little bit like the other nearly terrible mistake. About 5 years ago, I was on the short list for the Grammy New Age Music Award, and I thought, fuck, I hope I don't win that. Luckily, I didn't. But that was a little bit like winning the religion prize that year. Suddenly, all of the brothers in the college descended on me with a view to turning me into a priest, you know. This I realized, was the aspiration of the teaching there, to produce priests.
Okay.
So for about 6 weeks, until it became obvious that I wasn't ever going to become a priest, I got a lot of treats from the brothers.
Well, it's interesting that you say that you were never going to become a priest, but you have every week for the last 25 years led a community,
yeah.
The singing group that
yes.
meets. Do you want to say a bit about that?
Yeah, so that's true. And it's probably the most important part of my week. So it's a group of people. Some of them are musicians. Quite a few of them aren't. And we just get together every Tuesday evening and sing. We have a songbook of 84 songs, I think it is now. The one we'll be singing at the end of this is one of them. And we just sing. And it's such an unusual group of people. It's a funny mixture of people, including an insurance actuary, Britain's leading VAT barrister, a social worker, all sorts of mixed up people. And it's one of the happiest communities I've ever been in. And everybody in it is completely addicted to it. We'll do anything to get there every week. And it's very interesting because it's something about this balance between doing something together which has some sort of rule to it. It's not, we don't just get together and drink and all.
And you're quite bossy sometimes to the singers.
Am I? Am I really? I wonder if that's true. Yes. Well, no, I always call myself the friendly neo-fascist in the room. Because by now we've been singing together for 25 or 26 years. And some of the other members in the group have been in for most of that time. We have newcomers as well joining us. But of course, everybody's so friendly now that the temptation is to just sit and have a chat. But the thing that holds us together is the fact that we sing together. That is a special experience. That's a bonding type of experience beyond just chatting.
And you know, you were saying that the, you know, church, religion, priesthood doesn't work for you because of the, you know, not believing in the ideas or mm-hmm. the words. But I think what, when you're singing with that group and you're creating something in that moment, you know, that's never going to be recorded, it's never going to be performed.
Yeah.
It's just for that group in that moment.
Yeah.
Then, I don't know, it feels to me like there probably is some overlap in what can be experienced in a religious setting and mm-hmm. what is being experienced in that group of singers in you yes. know, creating something beautiful together, knowing your part, you know, everyone knowing that they are part of creating that.
Yes, you were part of Sunday Assembly for a while, weren't you?
Yeah.
Sunday Assembly is a, well, probably you all know about it. I only just recently found out about it, but it's essentially a group of people who get together to do the things that you do in church without the churchy part, without the religious part, shall we say. So it's about celebrating community by doing something together. And a lot of it, I think, is singing, isn't it?
Yeah, singing pop songs instead of hymns.
Yeah. So that, coming from a Catholic background, the doctrinal part of religion was always presented as the important part of it. But what I found when I started going to gospel churches was that, first of all, there wasn't an emphasis on doctrine. There was an emphasis on doing things together. That was what the whole experience was about. I don't know if you've, any of you have ever seen that beautiful film by Sophie Fiennes called Hoover Street Revival. So Sophie was friends with Grace Jones, the singer, and made a film about her. But during making this film, she met her brother, Grace's brother, who's called Bishop Noel Jones. And he runs this huge church in South Central LA. And it's a very poor part of LA, has a very big congregation. And the church offers almost everything that you would want a good government to be offering its citizens. It offers creches, it offers counseling. It, at the time of AIDS, it became a kind of AIDS center that people could go to. It offers after-school accommodation for kids who can't work at home because the home situation is too difficult. It does all the things you would want a good society to do for its citizens, and it's a church. And the whole emphasis of the church is not on discussions about sin and that kind of thing that you might imagine that kind of church would be. It's about singing together. They have a fantastic choir. And of course, everyone in the congregation is de facto a choir member. They all sing along. So anyway, it was seeing things like that. I started to think, this church is really a very functional part of this community. In fact, it is really this. It's the one thing that holds the community together. Everybody in the community respected the church. In one of the things you wrote, you said, you told a story about being in a service somewhere and somebody starts drilling the road outside. And somebody from the service goes out and says to the workman, sorry, we've got a church service going on. They immediately stopped. And you asked the question, would they have done that if they'd known that it was a church full of atheists? And does religion still have that kind of bracketing function where it says, even to people who aren't practicing, it says, this is something special and you have to respect it?
Mm.
And can you get that kind of respect for activities without that religious component? For instance, could... If Hoover Street Revival, that big church, existed and Bishop Noel Jones said, look, why don't we just cut out the middleman and just do all this stuff with each other and forget the religious part, would it work?
Right. Well, this is one of the things that I feel really fascinated by, having spent the first part of my career in healthcare
mm-hmm.
and thinking about the post-war context that the NHS was created in, when a lot more people were going to church.
Yeah.
And Britain was more homogeneously Christian. And I wonder how much those designers of the NHS took for granted that people would carry on going to church at the same level,
mm-hmm.
and what's been lost, you know, the societal glue that has been lost, you know, with people not taking part in religion as much, and also things like trade union membership and, you know, all yeah. sorts of other communities, people moving around the country more and not staying in the communities that they grew up in. You know, all of this community glue has dissolved very rapidly.
Yeah.
And so to me, it feels really clear that, well, of course there's a mental health crisis and a loneliness epidemic and, you know, all of the other sort of societal issues that we might name. Not to say that going to church is an easy fix for those things, mm-hmm. but there just was much more, support. And there is something different by a sort of professionally offered service, than a community held.
Yes.
And I think part of that is, you know, if you know that you are a recipient of a service, then it puts you in a different position than if you are a co-creator
yes.
or something.
Yes.
And that power, that, you know, that sense of power and respect and agency and belonging, you know, it's, that's so important for our own well-being
mm-hmm.
that any, you know, even the best professional service is never going to make people feel as good as if they are part of creating something together.
Yeah. Even in my little singing group, there's very much a feeling that everybody does something. Like, we always stop in the middle to sing and drink a bit, and people always bring things. And it's an important part of the chemistry of it. So it isn't, let's go to Brian's place and he'll tell us how to sing a song. That doesn't happen at all. It's, let's go to Brian's place and we'll do something together. And that was completely missing when I was a kid growing up in St. John's Catholic Church in Woodbridge, where you were invited to attend and watch something, and there was very little chance of engagement. And the few people who were engaged were altar boys and a few women who made cakes on certain special days and so on. But mostly it was just like voting, in the way that voting in the election is the extent of your participation in democratic activity. And it's a pathetic excuse for democracy. So I mean, I'm sure everyone knows this. Engagement is where you get the best of people. And I started thinking about this quite a lot. I went to art school and I loved art history, unlike most art students who didn't. I really liked the art history part. And I got very interested in Russian painting from the turn of the 20th century, sort of the revolutionary period from 1906 to 27 or so. And of course, I already knew all the major artist names, Kandinsky and Tatlin and Rodchenko and Popova and so on. But then I started trying to find out how that scene worked and why it was so super productive. So many movements came out of it. You know, within a few weeks, there was constructivism, suprematism, Rayonism, all these different isms, which were often one or two artists who'd given that what they were doing a name. But nonetheless, there was a huge amount of creative energy and revolutionary energy, actually. And so I thought, how did so much happen among people who weren't particularly wealthy or anything, didn't have much social power, you would have thought? It turned out that there was this whole scene of people around them, often partners, girlfriends and boyfriends, often wealthy middle class and richer nobles who set up situations where artists could meet each other and who liked having artists around because it was kind of a nice spice in the social stew, you know. And then there were gallerists and curators and critics and all sorts of people who were keeping this conversation going. And the more you looked at it, the more you realized that it was a little bit like watching mushrooms. So the mushroom, the fruit, appears. And that might be Kandinsky or Tatlin or one of the big names, but actually they're connected to a huge network underneath. So I thought it's wrong to call those people geniuses, as if they just appeared out of nowhere. You know, it was all in their head and suddenly they were there and it was amazing. And I came up with this other word, which some people use now, which is senius, which is the intelligence or the creativity of a whole community, of a whole scene. And when I started thinking about that, I thought, well, how can you arrange societies to be seniors, to be creative places where everybody has something to do and everybody is sort of important and connected? You know, democracy was supposed to be the place where that would triumph by using the sum of everybody's intelligence, not pitting intelligences against each other, but somehow synergizing them together. But it hasn't happened, unfortunately. That got lost in the last few years.
And there feels like something really important in congregations or communities as pockets of seniors. Mm-hmm. And how within them they will be creating a shared vision of the world.
Yeah.
And just how in the sort of secular world, or maybe in the artistic world, mm-hmm. that is what happens when mm-hmm. people are creating ideas together and playing with ideas together.
Yeah.
And you talked before about the church with all the, you know, all of the different services supporting the community, and feels really important that, you know, food banks and things like that are offering very, very practical help. But I guess it feels even more important in, you know, the state of the world as it is right now, where things can feel so impossible and stuck, mm-hmm. that it feels like that work of collective imagination is so important to allow us to find another way of moving, another way of acting. And so for the, you know, the majority of people in Britain today who don't take part in religion or don't have a space of creative, imaginative community, then it sort of feels like, well, no wonder it can feel that there's so much impossibility.
Yeah. Does it matter? By the way, can you still hear what now this other noise is going on? It's okay. This other noise. It's music stuff. Does it matter? So let me ask this another way. I often think that art is the process of making interesting fictions. I think art isn't about the depiction of reality so much as about the depiction of other possible realities. So, you know, if you read a novel, what you're doing is you're immersing yourself in the world of the novel and seeing what happens, how the dynamics of the situation work, having feelings about it, of course. That's the whole point. The product of art is feelings. So this is a way of sort of suggesting to you, what would a world like that be like? Or what would a world like this be like? And so on and so on. And we know that those are fictions. We're reading novels. We don't expect them to be true. In fact, it's rather important that they aren't true, because then we can manipulate them. We can think of other ways they could have turned out.
And you can imagine yourself belonging in it more than if you're reading a biography or yes. something. You're like, well, that happened without me.
Yes, you know? That's right. That was somebody else's life.
Yeah.
But so in art, I think we're quite happy to accept the idea of something being fictional, but still useful, still important, still part of our imaginative process. But if you had said to those workmen outside your church, we're kind of doing this fictional theater thing together, it's called church, but actually it's a fiction, would that have commanded their respect, I wonder?
I doubt it.
Yeah, I doubt it as well. But is it important for religious people that it's non-fiction or fiction?
This has been something that I have been following the thread of, I think, from arriving at church, you know, as an adult for the first time, really strongly rooted in the world of science, mm-hmm. And having studied neuroscience and sort of thinking, okay, well, you know, have a basic understanding of human consciousness, and, you know, and I like it's a material, you know, I'm taking a material approach to understanding the world. And being in a congregation led by a scientist, atheist minister, then that was part of it as well. And really learning a lot about how to live well and all of the rest, and a level of depth that was really important to me. But it was following other threads that, and finding ritual to be valuable. Like, mm-hmm. I think in the past, I sort of thought, well, that doesn't, you know, that doesn't do anything. Of course, no magic happens if you're, you know, it's kind of old fashioned mumbo jumbo.
Yeah.
But I think I've since come back to it. And I think from conversations with people in the world of sort of theatre and the arts and understanding, yeah, of course you're creating something real. Mm-hmm. It's just a different kind of real to science.
Yes.
And I think the problem comes when we mix up the ways of understanding the world and try to understand things of feelings, emotions, the transcendent, you know, universal, endless beauty through the lens of science. Mm-hmm. It's just the wrong tool for the job.
Yes. But the thing about feelings is important, I think. In either case, the feelings are real, actually. Whether the source is fictional or factual, the feelings can be real. And feelings have a kind of bad reputation in science because they're hard to quantify and hard to compare and so on, hard to investigate. They don't stay still. You can't put them under a microscope in the same way. So feelings have been left out, I think, quite unfairly, whereas feelings are really where humans make their biggest decisions. You know, your decision about who you fall in love with isn't based on spreadsheets and data. It's based on something else.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, maybe it's a bit of a stereotype to think of, you know, British people particularly being very uncomfortable talking about our feelings. Mm-hmm. But I think that there is something important in, you know, maybe church was a space where British people could be in touch with the, you know, bigger, deeper feelings.
Yeah.
That in, you know, in a conversation, you'd sort of pretend that you had none. and certainly that was really important for me when I found myself belonging to a congregation. It was like, oh, here's a place where people are talking to each other about their inner, mm-hmm. inner worlds. And so, you know, I'm again in sort of looking at what does it mean for Britain when so few people take part in communities like this? You know, where are people engaging with their inner worlds together?
Yes.
And recognizing that it's really different to, you know, seeing a therapist or something where it's a kind of one-to-one, usually private,
you know,
privately paid for relationship. It sort of feels like, well, yes, that's really, really valuable, but it's not alive in the culture mm-hmm. in a way that we really need to be happening.
Yeah.
You know, as we navigate what lies ahead, we need to be really good at holding the fear and despair and hope and joy and, you know, all of the sort of deepest feelings that we're holding with us as, you know, in challenging situations. If we don't know how to be with them well together in community,
yeah,
then, you know, We kind of see what unfolds.
Well, they get buried then, and they turn into something else.
And people make bad voting decisions.
Yes, a friend of mine, he just died a couple of years ago, called John Hassell, great musician and thinker, who was capable of very complex thoughts. Would sometimes come up with some very simple expressions of these. And one of them he said once was, the most important question you can ask yourself is, what is it I really like? And it seems such an obvious thing when you first hear that, but actually that is a very deep question, because we live in a world where there are thousands of people paid millions of dollars to engineer what we shall like and what we shall take seriously. So our feelings are a kind of battleground. They're a place that everybody is trying to occupy. Politicians, advertisers. Advertising is the biggest industry in the world. You know, Google, Facebook, all of those things, they're all about advertising. That is the central industry there. It isn't connecting people or giving them interesting information on Wikipedia. It's advertising. And what does advertising exist for? It exists to tell you what you ought to be liking, what you ought to be attracted by and repelled by. And politics has become the same thing as well. So there's this absolute tsunami of stuff trying to manipulate our opinions and our feelings. And it's very, very important, I think, to have something in your life where you can go. It can just be a space in your mind and say, what really matters to me? Where does it really happen for me? Where am I really moved by something? And this has been, for me, the importance of art throughout my life, of finding things that move me in ways I don't quite understand. You know, I remember when I was, I think, 10 or 11, my uncle, who was an amateur watercolor painter, but he liked talking to me about art. And he had this tiny little book, 6 inches by 4 inches, about Piet Mondrian. And he bought it for me. He gave it to me. And I remember opening this book and seeing these Mondrian paintings, you know, the geometrical ones with three primary colors. Very simple. You can generate them, millions of them, with a computer program now. I remember opening these and thinking, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. I was so affected by it. And part of the effect was the magic of it, because I thought, why am I having these feelings about some colored boxes, basically? Why do I find that so attractive? And it became really the central problem of my question of my life, not problem, a question that I enjoyed trying to answer. Why do I find something so beautiful or moving or inspiring or energizing? And the attempt to answer that problem over the last, well, at least 70 years, I think I was 7 when I first started asking the question, when I heard the first single I ever owned was Get a Job by The Silhouettes. Nobody else here is old enough to remember that song, but it's a doo-wop song. Sha-da-da-da. With one of those kind of voices in it. And I can remember as a 7-year-old thinking, where does this come from, this feeling? And I think I was chasing those feelings forever afterwards. And of course, going to a Catholic school where they didn't have those feelings. Nobody apparently had those feelings. Or if they did, they never talked about them. We never did doo-wop in church when I was young. But it was this sense of art being a place where you could build either the world you want to be in or the world you thought would be terrifying, and you could build those worlds as well, you know. I mean, people, when I talk about things like this, people think it's always utopian this that I'm talking about, but I'm not. I'm talking about world making. So George Orwell making the world of 1984 is doing the same thing. He's saying, what about this world? And you go, oh, terrible. That's useful too, to mm-hmm. know. It's useful to know what you don't like as well as it's useful to know what you do like. And I suppose one way I can think about religion is that it's a series of fictions, and I'm not using fiction in a pejorative way here, but it's a series of fictions or mind games, you might say, parables, they actually use that word, that give you a structure on which to have feelings. I don't like this, I do like this. Now, if you take it for if you accept the idea that feelings are really the way we navigate through a lot of our lives, a lot of the important decisions, the first reactions you have to things are at the basis of feelings, then it becomes very important to start thinking about those and to give them the dignity of a proper place to happen.
And I think if we're not consciously tending to the feelings that are created in us, then we are at the mercy of, you know, the billboards that we walk past, yeah, or the, you know, even things like architecture and like street design and things like that, that we're living among without necessarily thinking, oh, someone else has created this. Mm-hmm. It's still influencing how we see the world and how we feel about ourselves and our place in the world. And so, yeah, that practice of paying attention and to the feelings that we want to cultivate.
Yes. Yes.
And it feels so important that, you know, yes, that can be a purely private thing, but there's something sort of exponentially powerful that happens, yes, when it's done with other people.
Yes, that's the whole thing, the synergy of doing something with other people. I mean, back to my singing group, every Tuesday night we do this. I would never do that on my own. It's in fact, quite often, if there weren't other people involved, I would just cancel it because I'm often tired and I think, oh God, we're singing again tonight. Within 5 minutes, I'm completely happy that we did it. But yes, people support each other in that way. You know, you create a structure that you don't want to let down, and that's what keeps you up.
And when the feeling that you're cultivating is counter to the current of the mainstream, mm-hmm, it's tiring to keep creating, yes, that little bubble for yourself.
Yes.
And, you know, and that feels so important that we are collectively, you know, creating the feelings that belong to the world that we want to live in, mm-hmm, so that is being strengthened. And we can imagine more, like the stronger the sense of it is, the more you can imagine in it, in that world.
Yes. Yes. And it's also important to know that creating new worlds involves sometimes creating the soil from which they will grow. And this is a sort of the kind of unglamorous part of world creation. Everybody's amazed when, you know, Matisse comes out with an amazing painting, or Jackson Pollock or Picasso or something like that. Everybody's amazed by those singular sort of explosions. But nobody is quite as interested in the soil that they grew from. And I've more and more start to think that religion is the process of tending the soil from which human activity can grow. And any good farmer knows that that's important. You don't just kind of bung a load of fertilizers on and get three crops and then the soil's exhausted. If you want to make something that lasts for a long time, you have to think about that long time. And one interesting thing to note is that news in general is about things that happen quickly, things that are fast and dramatic. News is never about long, slow processes.
You don't get a state of the soil report.
No, and there should be, actually. Mm. You know, that would be important to know.
Yeah.
And it's only, you know, this is the struggle that environmentalism has, that the news only really works when a huge ice shelf collapses or there's an enormous fire in Brazil or something like that. But it doesn't ever tell us about the long-term processes that might have given rise to that. I just thought we should perhaps ask people a question.
Yeah.
We wrote down a question that we wanted everyone to consider, and we might talk about it.
Yeah.
In fact, I wrote down loads of things here that we haven't talked about.
I know.
And so did you.
Yeah.
Even more than me.
But the question that we wanted to invite you all to think about and just take a moment to speak with someone who's nearby, is where in your life do you have the deepest feelings?
Yeah. So which are the, you know, like my moment of the Mondrian was one of those moments for me. But there are other versions of it. There are deep, long, slow relationships that you often don't think about very much, but then you realize actually they are the fundamental kind of currents that your life is run on. So we want to just see what I think the reason we're asking this question is saying, if we want to invent a new idea of the relationship between religion and the rest of society, what we're really looking for is a new kind of behavior. But is it new? This is the question. Are we already doing it in some way, but perhaps not naming it or calling it something else? You know, are there instances in all of our lives where we're already making these things happen? So that's the question. What do you do when you want that feeling? I mean, I get a lot of it by just going into the studio and starting to fiddle around in this private little world that I know I'm ultimately going to share with other people. So it's not completely private. It's done with the consciousness that other people will share it eventually. Mm. And sometimes that's all you want from a community. That's enough to be in tune with that community, enough to care about what you do in relation to it. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I release something new, I don't even read criticisms because it just pisses me off. It pisses me off if it's flattering, and it pisses me off if it's critical. So I don't have much space for it. I forget who it was. Somebody said, I don't read reviews, I weigh them. Just how much is it? So the other thing I've got on my list of things we want to talk about was outsiderness. Many years ago, I discovered this museum in Lausanne called the Musée de l'Art Brut, which is the Museum of Outsider Art, essentially. These are people who don't classify themselves as artists, who many of them are institutionalized. Some of them are lonely people who've been working on their own. Nobody's ever seen their work until they died. One of the people exhibiting in this, or who is exhibited in this museum, is a housewife who died in her late 60s, and in her drawers, the underwear drawers and the clothes drawers, they discovered something like 15,000 drawings. None of her family had ever seen them. She'd done this entirely privately, and they're the most beautiful, delicate drawings, tiny and done in a very hard pencil, so and very detailed. So when you first look at them, it just looks like a grey sheet of paper. Then you realize it's the most intricate drawing. So if you go to the Musée de l'Art Brut in Lausanne, you will see some of the most amazing art you've ever seen. It's my favorite museum in Europe. It's just sensational to see how much creativity burns inside people and how rarely we let it out.
Well, I went there last year on your recommendation. I found it incredibly moving because these were people that were not artistically trained at all in mm-hmm. the most part. And so that very direct expression of something that hasn't been honed by a set of rules that yeah. are kind of art school approved or whatever. It's someone's sort of very direct expression. And it made me realize that it's really rare to experience the intensity of someone else's, you know, inner world, particularly mm-hmm. as you say, they're people who are, you know, really on the edges of things.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they were, you know, just, you know, beautiful and inspiring and horrific in lots of ways as well. You know, it was a real, you know, real, you know, depth of, depth of life experience and expression.
Yes. So it was looking at those paintings and sculptures in that museum. I've been going there for 40 years at least now. It made me think, what's the equivalent of outsider art in music? And I've puzzled about that for years. Why isn't there an outsider fringe in music? And then one day I suddenly thought, Well, there is. It's called pop music. That's outsider art. You know, it doesn't come out of the academy. It doesn't come from music schools. Music schools generally hate it. It comes from people thinking, fuck, I'd like to do that.
And doing it for themselves.
And doing it for themselves, yes. And of course, now it's become academicized. There are schools where you can do pop music courses now. But effectively, most of the music comes from virtually untutored people. And I thought, that's outsider art. And then I started looking at other things that people do. Politics. The most interesting politics is not coming from politicians. It's coming from outsiders who are sort of infringing into their area, often environmentalists, but often people that things like this. I mean, what we're talking about is it's not beliefs. It's about how society works, mm-hmm. how else it could be. This is outsider politics, I would say. There's outsider architecture. There's outsider everything. What's happened is that the centers of things have become dead, actually. Mm-hmm. Just like what happens in a tree. You know,
yeah.
Of course, the tree grows and it keeps, it's the stuff on the outside that's living and learning and adapting. Stuff on the inside is dead. And, you know, I think things that are dead are more stable now than they ever were in history before. There's a process of ossification that happens that keeps the centers, gives them more power than they should have.
Right.
And their resistance to the change on the outside is stronger.
Yeah, and thinking about religion through that lens, thinking of the pop music example of people, you know, teaching themselves to play the guitar and, you know, making up a pop song, you know, I feel really strongly that we really need that in religion, you know, to recognize that this is a universal human thing that humans have been doing forever.
Yeah.
And yes, we have these ancient institutions that are saying, well, actually, we've got the right way of doing it.
Yep. And here's the doctrine that goes with it.
Yeah. And so, you know, just holding that question of what does it look like to invite people into creating what they need for now, mm-hmm. knowing that people and communities can move and adapt much more quickly and ably than institutions can. And so, yeah, I'm interested in what that looks like.
We've both been reading a book recently by Robin Dunbar, who's the guy who gave us the Dunbar number for the ideal number of people in a community, a functional community, which is 150, by the way. But he wrote a really interesting book. I think it was published 2 years ago, called The Evolution of Religion. And it's very, very, very interesting. And it's, the funny thing is that Dunbar is obviously fiercely resisting becoming too sympathetic to the subject as he writes the book. He's a very good scientist, and I can sort of feel him clinging to his science. I won't fucking let go of this. He's really struggling. But it's a lovely book. But one of the things he says in that is that one of the characteristics of religions is that they keep fragmenting. So you have the big mainstream religions, but always there are these spin-offs, these small religions. I was so aware of this when I was in Brazil. I had a friend who worked in the favelas in São Paulo. And every sort of six houses, there was a little church. And the churches were a third of the size of this stage. And they were made of corrugated tin. And they were beautifully colored and full of life and had weird sound systems that played very loud music. And they were churches with tiny congregations. And I realized that what had happened there was that the big churches were too big for people. They wanted to be in the congregation, the active, living, cutting edge, fresh congregation. They didn't want to be in the old church. Anyway, we better do something else.
Should we ask people just to have a moment with someone sitting nearby just to talk about that question? You know, where is it in your life that you are experiencing the deepest feelings? And just to take a couple of minutes and we'll hear back from just a few people. So we just invite you to have a little chat with the person near you now.
Thank you, first of all, for an absolutely enthralling time we've had here. I don't know that I can plan when those moments of magic are going to happen. Sometimes you realize without having planned, yeah, that was something tremendously important and really good.
Thank you. There's someone right the other side, sitting down.
Part of the ambition of religion is to try to be able to plan it, to try to engineer situations where it does happen. Isn't that part of what art is doing as well, is to say, okay, these efflorescences of the spirit, if you like, are rare and ephemeral, but we know a few tricks to how to make them happen. That's what being an artist is, isn't it? It's sort of knowing a few tricks that, for instance, just a little side story. We've got to shut up soon, haven't we? But someone did some research at Edinburgh University on what are the universal things in music that everybody responds to. And they did it by sitting people in chairs that had a button. And when something in the music really moves you, you press the button. The only thing that was consistent across all cultures and all types of people was this thing called appoggiatura. Appoggiatura is when a note belonging to one chord hangs over unexpectedly into the next one, or the other way around, when a note moves up in a strange way in relation to a chord. So it's a certain kind of unexpectedness. But this turns out to be something, once you start listening to it, you hear it absolutely everywhere. And that's a piece of sort of engineering to make that kind of feeling that you're talking about.
It sounds a bit like how jokes work as well, yeah, where you sort of have something unexpected in...
It's very exactly like that, yes. Anyway, that was an aside.
There's a
one of many
the back
fascinating
there.
Asides I could or have made if we had longer to talk.
Yeah, go for it.
Hi. Yeah, I at the moment feel the most when I watch film and then write. And so, for example, I saw the film that you released last year, and that made me think of my father who died 20 years ago, who had this massive record collection that we then had to disband a bit, but I still have. And that made me write about the records that I remember growing up with and my earliest memories as a child, and the covers of the records and what they, the artwork of the records as well as the actual music. And that from that, I just, I wrote a piece about him. And so, it's like art begets art.
Yeah, very much it does.
And helps my mental health.
Yeah, the main subject of art is art, actually. It's true. People think, that means it's about nothing. But it doesn't. It means it's about us recognizing and trying to revisit feelings again and again.
We're going to sing together in a moment, and we're going to have a few people helping to lead the singing. So I might invite them to make their way up here while we hear from one other person who wants to share something of where they feel their deepest feelings.
There's two people in that direction there. Yeah.
Oh, right. Put your hand in the air again.
You first. Yeah.
I wanted to ask a question rather than say about the deepest feeling. And my question was, I'm a vicar, so I'm involved in leading a community. I know a lot of people by organized religion have been kind of deprogrammed from using their imagination. I loved what you said about the seniors, and I wondered how you would think about training or retraining a community in imagination.
That's a very nice thought.
It reminds me of the conversation that we had about what if all the churches became art schools.
Yeah. This is a project that Liz and I have been working on to cleverly change churches into being active art schools, but still call them by whatever name they have, you know.
Well, I think they're doing the same thing. Like you said, that, you know, there's no reason why churches shouldn't be places of imagination.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, there's every reason why they should be. You know, if you get away from the idea of the church as being a place that transmits received truth, which is the sort of classical Catholic idea, that truth all sort of sits out there somewhere and you just have to put a lightning rod on top of a building and it will come into the building. That's not what I see at all. Truth is something that we are all making all the time. And it changes as well. It isn't eternal. Things change. That's a pragmatist point of view, but I think that's true. What did you say? One more?
Yeah. Have we got time for one last one?
One last one. Yeah.
Thank you. So what I've thought about more and more in the last few years as I've looked back on my life and what I've built and my career and everything is what really matters is relationships. Mm-hmm. And I'm a Christian. And, you know, when Jesus was asked, what's the most important thing? He said, love God and love your neighbor. And he made it clear his neighbor was everybody, including the stranger. And it feels to me a lot of what you've talked about is the power of doing things together about community, communal singing. I'm in a choir as well. Art, so much of it is most powerful when it's collective.
Yeah, yeah. I have to say, if I were the king, I would have singing every day at school. And I would suggest it in every organization as well. I think it's such a powerful way of equalizing people, essentially, you know, because when you sing, you're slightly vulnerable. You're making yourself a little bit vulnerable because other people can see you doing this thing that you might not do all the time and you might not be that comfortable with. But that act of allowing yourself to be vulnerable just levels the playing field. Mm-hmm. Suddenly everybody looks just as silly as everyone else. And it's fine.
It would be wonderful if instead of having prayers at the beginning of the day in the Houses of Parliament, they all sang.
God, wouldn't it be so fantastic? Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's a young man in this audience, Moses French, who's going to write that song.
Okay.
You're going to write the Parliament song, right? Yeah.
Brilliant.
I'll give you a hand.
Okay. Is that a good point to start singing?
Yeah, yeah, that's a good idea.
Do you want to introduce it?
This is a song by, I always forget her name.
The band is called Mamouz.
Mamouz, yes. What's her name, the lady who wrote it? Kerisha? I can't remember. Anyway, it's a lovely song. It's a very simple song in the sense that there's only this one verse and one chorus that goes round and round and round. It has a bit of funny timing in it, which I shall try to indicate. But most of you have probably heard it anyway. It's called We Shall Be Known. And what we shall do is get a few very well-paid allies on stage here. Here they are, look, rolling in money. And we hope... Oh, can you put the lyrics on? There we are. Oh, so you'll have to stand. Let's stand each side. We need more on this side. There you go. That's fine. And we need to not cover these words up for the people at the side here. Oh, and I need the key of C.
Oh, yeah.
Why don't you get a bit closer to the mic? Because you're a good leader.
Oh.
One, two.
We shall be known by the company we keep, by the ones who circle round to tend these fires. We shall be known by the ones ones who sow and reap the seeds of change alive from deep within the earth. It is time now. It is time now that we thrive. It is time we lead ourselves into the well. It is time now, and what a time to be alive. In this great turning we shall learn to lead in love. In this great turning we shall learn to lead in love. We shall be known by the company we keep, by the ones who circle round to tend these fires. We shall be known by the ones who sow and reap the seeds of change alive from deep within the earth. It is time now. It is time now that we thrive. It is time we lead ourselves into the well. It is time now, and what a time to be alive. In this great turning we shall learn to lead in love. In this great turning we shall learn to lead in love.
Last time, all join in.
We shall be known by the company we keep, by the ones who circle round to tend these fires. We shall be known by the ones who sow and reap the seeds of change alive from deep within the earth. It is time now. It is time now that we thrive. It is time we lead ourselves into the well. It is time. Turning, we shall learn to lead in love. In this great turning, we shall learn to lead in love.
Thank you very much to our singers and to all of you for joining in.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.